Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Following a career in journalism, my guest today was appointed by two successive prime ministers as special advisor to four cabinet ministers. Having worked on tactical and strategic advice, as well as crisis management at the highest levels of government, he has huge insight into some rarely seen aspects of life in Whitehall. His book, The Secret Life of Special Advisors, reveals all this, detailing the roles of people like Dominic Cummings and Alistair Campbell, and what they're really like. Peter Cardwell, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you, Georgina. It's lovely to be here. Lovely to be back on Monocle.
Well, that's the thing is, of course, that your voice will be recognisable to Monocle listeners because you did spend some time presenting for us.
Yes, many happy mornings, sometimes even presenting with you, Georgina, which was an absolute pleasure to if you're going to be forced into a position where you're a bit craggy and a bit tired first thing in the morning, your spirits will be livened by seeing your lovely face and co-presenting with you. So it was a lovely experience.
Oh dear. Well, thank you very much for that. Let's go back though, because before being appointed by two successive prime ministers as special advisor to four cabinet ministers in four different government departments, you had an eventful career in television, also a really impressive education. It all started off in Ireland. Tell us, where were you born?
I was born in a place called Craigavon, but I grew up in a village called Rich Hill, which is just outside Armagh in Northern Ireland, about 30 miles from Belfast. So I had a very nice, I've often said I'd be a terrible novel writer because I had a very happy childhood. And I just had a very sort of stable, pretty straightforward nuclear family with my parents were both teachers and always encouraged a love of books and reading, but also curiosity. And I was one of those children who read a lot and watched the news. And of course, that was at the tail end of the Troubles, really. So coming up to the Belfast Agreement in 1998. So really my childhood was watching both bombs going off and the consequences of that. But it, as it went on, certainly the Belfast Agreement and peace coming to Northern Ireland. So it was pretty dramatic in terms of what was happening, you know, a short space away from me, but in our little village, it felt probably like a pretty normal, pretty typical childhood.
And it fostered in you a love for politics, really.
Yes, it's funny, neither of my parents is political at all. We didn't know any politicians. We didn't even know any journalists, actually. We knew one journalist who was a friend of my dad's, sort of a family friend. But he was helpful at one stage in the early part of my career. But I mean, lovely though he was, I wouldn't say he was a sort of defining influence. So yeah, it's funny, actually. It was really just watching television news and reading the paper. And it was just so interesting in terms of what was going on. And I remember when I was about 13, we had to do a talk in class about just, you know, whatever was of interest to us, whatever our topic was. And most people did, you know, I remember one boy talked about the World Cup and lots of people talk about football teams or sports or whatever. And, you know, I talked about the Belfast Agreement. I think it had just been signed a couple of months previously, if I remember correctly. And I gave a talk about that. So I was one of those quite nerdy kids who was always interested in kind of the world around him and British politics and American politics as well. And we felt sort of, even though you were in a pretty sleepy village in Northern Ireland, you felt somehow connected. And that, I suppose, connected me, journalism connected me to the outside world in a way that wasn't the case for many people.
And what did you go on to study and where?
So I did history and politics at Oxford University at St Hugh's College. So I had a brilliant politics teacher for A-level at a school in Portadown, just a town about 6 miles away from Rich Hill. So a really, really good guy called Sean Dunlop, who taught me both history and politics. And I knew that was what I wanted to do. I was pretty good at English, but I was destined to do history and politics, and went to Oxford to do that, which I was very privileged to be able to do.
And you were also a Fulbright scholar.
That's right, yeah. I worked for a year in journalism after Oxford. I was sort of doing a bit of work experience and got some short contracts and things. Worked at Newsnight with Jeremy Paxman, which was great. But then early in that sort of academic year, straight after university, I applied for a Fulbright scholarship. It's actually called the Alistair Cook Fulbright Scholarship after the great man himself. We all remember the letter from America. And that's another thing I listened to growing up. And then off I went to Columbia School of Journalism for a year. And actually, there's a lovely story in that I was approached by a woman, I should say, called Eliza Browning, who I had been in my class with at Columbia for about 6 weeks, and we got on pretty well. We'd sort of become friends. And she said, "Oh, I heard you have a Fulbright scholarship." And I said, "Yeah, it's named after someone you've probably never heard of, but a very famous British journalist in America called Alistair Cook." And she said, "I have heard of him because he was my grandfather."
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. And what was lovely was that her father and mother brought me to a really nice, a really beautiful restaurant called Café des Artistes on the upper West Side, which was Alistair Cook's favourite restaurant. And we all sat there and had a beautiful meal one evening when I was at Columbia, which was far, far outside the range of my student budget, it must be said. But it was quite strange to think the next generation really were studying where the great man had held court in that restaurant.
Absolutely. Peter, you went on to work in television. Tell me about those morning shows.
Yes, I worked, I think, on two morning programmes. One was a very tabloidy programme for BBC Northern Ireland called Stephen Nolan Show. He's maybe known to some Monocle listeners as a sort of late night host on Five Live, and I didn't get on very well. I didn't enjoy it very much, but because it was a bit too tabloidy for me. But one programme I worked on as well was Good Morning Britain alongside Piers Morgan. And having done a lot of TV that was quite kind of intellectually stimulated, like Newsnight, To a Lesser Degree Question Time, Sky News I worked for as well. Of course, it's a very, very dynamic and sort of there's nothing quite like 24-hour news when, you know, you're sitting reading the paper or something and then something dramatic happens and you've got to sort of leap into action. But no, I spent 2 years on Good Morning Britain as a reporter and was sent to all sorts of places, including Malta, bizarrely, and all around Britain to do all sorts of reports. But certainly working with Piers Morgan was not dull. He is a very, very interesting person and someone who pops up in the book as well. So that was definitely punishing because the overnight shifts, I didn't do that many of them. I think you did about six a month you literally started work at 10 p.m. and finished at 9:30 the next morning, and you sort of emerge blinking into the sunlight, headed for your bed, and you see everybody walking towards you in the other direction from the tube station on their way to work. And it's not a pretty healthy lifestyle either, because you tend to eat rubbish, and of course working overnight is not good for your body. I think you can work late into the night, say 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock or something, or get up very early in the morning and just about get away with it. But I think actually working overnight is really bad for you. I did it for 2 years, as I say, only sort of six or seven shifts a month, but it takes it out of you. It definitely does. And I'm glad I don't do it anymore.
And was that one of the reasons that you decided to change direction in your career?
Not hugely. I mean, it was part of it, I suppose. But also, I'd been in journalism for 10 years. I'd done a lot. I'd been really interested in what I'd done. I'd done a lot of politics. I'd done breaking news. I'd done morning programmes. I'd done evening programmes. I'd done Tea Time News. I'd been on the Tea Time News in Northern Ireland for 2 years as well as a reporter, you know, as part of a sort of pretty small team in the ITV region, the sort of UTV, it's called Ulster Television. And I'd sort of done a lot of things. And I think that I was looking for the next move. I wasn't quite sure what it was. I think I either wanted to become a political correspondent or go into politics. And what's interesting is that when I, as I said in the book, when I was in working for Newsnight, part of my job was to get to know these curious creatures, the special advisors, and convince them that despite the fact they'd been up very early in the morning, what they really wanted to do was go to West London at sort of 10:30 at night and have their minister beaten up by Jeremy Paxman. So after a whole day of, you know, the opposition and interest groups and so on rubbishing their policy. So it was a pretty tough job, but I got to know quite a lot of them. And that Newsnight job is actually quite an interesting one that I did working with sort of on the political team, because you get to know a lot of people. And it really, I think I got the Westminster bug really, in that it's a fascinating place. I was working in Four Millbank, where a lot of broadcasters have their Westminster Bureau. And I just really enjoyed it. I got to know a lot of politicians. I got to know a heck of a lot of special advisors and other researchers and so on, and got into that kind of social world. And I think I was probably just missing that a little bit with Good Morning Britain, because I covered a bit of politics and, well, quite a lot of politics, but I didn't cover it all the time. And then, you know, the stars aligned essentially, and one of the special advisors I'd known from Newsnight days, Fiona Hill, became chief of staff to Theresa May at Downing Street. And then I sent her off my CV and thought I'd never hear another word about it. And then very, very quickly, I became a special advisor at the Northern Ireland office, which was something I wasn't anticipating, and something that came as a very, very pleasant surprise. And it was It was strange, actually, because I think some of my colleagues at Good Morning Britain kind of knew better than I did. My sort of, I mean, I was very, very careful, obviously, as a journalist, not to betray my personal politics. But there was one editor at Good Morning Britain in particular who just went, well, I'm delighted but not surprised, you know, that I was joining the Conservative Party, joining the government and moving in that direction, because she had always seen me as more of a political animal than someone who was, you know, happy doing stories about, I don't know, Rita Ora or Beyonce or something. It seemed probably to them, it seemed a very logical move, whereas to me, it felt like a dramatic shift.
So exactly what is a special advisor or a SPAD?
So it's a sort of senior ministerial aide. You're everything. You're not part of the civil service per se. You're technically a temporary civil servant, but you're not really part. So civil servants, there are 96,000 civil servants in Whitehall, in the kind of part of Westminster where all the government departments are. They are impartial, so they can obviously work for a Boris Johnson government, or if Keir Starmer were to win in 2024, they could work for that government. So they can straddle different political leadership teams. But special advisors are party political, so you are meant to be a member of the party you're part of. I was and still am a member of the Conservative Party, and you work directly with a cabinet minister. So you're their eyes and ears, essentially. You're the political aide. You make sure that everything they're doing has a political purpose, is politically necessary. And whilst civil servants might say this is a great idea, what you've got to do is to work out, will the party be happy with it? Will backbenchers be happy with it? Is this something that you can sell to Number 10 and the Treasury? You also deal with, they sort of split the role into policy special advisors and media special advisors. And of course, I was a media special advisor. So you talk to the media a lot. Every department has a press office. And one department I worked in, we had 67 people in a press office, which is always seemed to me to be a lot of people. And but your role is to sort of say, this is what the minister thinks. And often civil servants will come to you and say, "What? How is he or she likely to react to if we put this policy in front of them?" And it's your job to know their mind, as well as talking to them very, very frankly about whether things will fly politically, whether things are a good idea or not. And also very menial things, like one of my boss's wives rang me up one day to say, ask me whether it was all right to wear jeans in a photo shoot with the Daily Mail. And I had to sort of advise her to dress a bit more high level in terms of put something a little smarter on. So that was a very, you know, you have these very, very strange kind of things where one minute you're going to Downing Street for a meeting of the Prime Minister, and then the next year you're heading out to buy sort of cough lozenges or something because your minister's got a sore throat. So it's a very, very strange job, but you sort of stick to them like glue. I traveled around a lot, especially when I was in the Northern Ireland office. You know, I flew a lot to Belfast with my bosses, stayed, you know, in some of the same accommodation in Hillsborough Castle occasionally, which is both the Queen and the Northern Ireland Secretary's residence in Northern Ireland. So I stayed in a separate flat there, but nonetheless, you know, just up the stairs kind of thing. And it's a cheap by agile existence, and you've got to get on with the person. And if you don't, you're in trouble, really.
Peter, I wonder how those key relationships in Westminster work.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one because there's no simple answer to that question. I was extremely lucky in that, I mean, I worked for four cabinet ministers. I got on well with all of them. One I got on with particularly well, James Brokenshire, who was the Northern Ireland Secretary, and then I worked with him a second time when he was the Housing Secretary. He sort of brought back after he was off for a period. He had cancer and was treated for it. But in terms of how the relationships work, I mean, you've got to remember it's a professional relationship. But at the same time, I saw more of probably all my bosses than their families did during the time I was with them. And you've got to remember that, you know, it's a confidential relationship. It's a very, almost a sort of professional, but nonetheless fairly intimate relationship. You know quite a lot about their lives and what they're up to. And, you know, if there are problems in their marriage or if they're frustrated about something or if they're just having a bad day kind of thing, you're the person they generally talk to about it. And it really depends on the minister as well. Some of them have certain personalities are open books. Some people take a long time to get to know. Some people tell you their innermost thoughts from the start. I remember when I worked with Robert Buckland, for example, the current Justice Secretary, he said, "Oh, well, I've never had special advisors before, so I don't really know. I mean, it'll probably take you a while to know what my opinions are." And I didn't say it at the time, but I was thinking, I was thinking it at the time. I thought, you know, Robert, I know more about your opinions in the first 6 minutes of meeting you than I did about James Brokenshire's opinions in the first 6 months of knowing him. So it very much depends on the person and the personalities involved, I would say.
And how much influence then do SPADs have?
I think quite a lot. It depends on the spot. I mean, some of them, there are over 100 of them in the Westminster government at the moment. Some of them are glorified bag carriers. Some of them are just there to sort of smooth down the minister and say, darling, aren't you wonderful? But others, I think, do have a huge amount of power and can sometimes sort of block things from going to the minister, block policies, will work actively to change things or to push things. I mean, Dominic Cummings, of course, was the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson's chief aide for quite a while before he dramatically left government just a few weeks ago, coming up to about a month ago, actually. And he was, you know, definitely the most influential of the lot, and someone who really, you know, he was someone who a lot of people have a lot of criticism about. I certainly have my criticisms of him. He wasn't perfect. But in terms of what he went into government to achieve, there were really three things that he went into government to achieve. And within, you know, less than sort of 14, 15 months, he managed to achieve all three of them. One was to get Brexit done. The second was to win a majority for the Conservatives, or be part of winning a majority for the Conservatives at the 2019 election. And the third one was to implement at least a bit, or start the process of civil service reform in this country. And, you know, he did all three, or at least started all three. And that's a greater legacy, I think, than many, certainly any special advisor I know, and most ministers as well, actually, because what you've got to remember in government is that time is really, really short. Most ministers have 18 months to 2 years in the department. David Cameron was Prime Minister for 6 years. That's still not very long. You know, and it's really not since the days of Tony Blair that we've had any Prime Minister who's had that long in government. So you've got to sort of start doing things from day one. And, you know, the civil service will, I'm a big fan of the civil service in most regards, but they will sort of pile up your red box and they will sort of, you know, get you to do things. And the key point is just prioritising and realising, you know, what is there and what needs to be done in the short space you're there. And special advisors can help the minister say to the department, this is a priority. And by nature of this being a priority, other things aren't priorities. And that's very, very useful strategic direction for departments. In fact, in the housing department, James and there are three special advisors to him at that point, we actually produced an A4 page, which was sent round the department saying, these are the priorities of the Secretary of State. You know, don't bring him stuff that's not a priority. And that was very, very helpful for the department.
Now, many would say that Cummings' legacy was actually really toxic. What did you think of him as a person?
Well, I worked with him pretty closely on a few things. I think very, very decisive. As we say in Northern Ireland, not much crack. You couldn't really imagine sort of going for a pint with him or something. I think he's someone who, you know, the wheels are always moving. I don't imagine he has a huge amount of downtime or does too many things that are just for laughs, really. Certainly, he was decisive. You always knew where you were. You always knew what his thoughts were. He certainly expressed himself in very, very clear terms. I definitely see there was a toxicity there. There was a lack of structure as well. And I mean, he didn't take the title Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister because, in my view, he didn't need to. He knew he had the power. And also, with Chief of Staff comes quite a lot of accountability. There's a direct line to you when things go wrong, whereas with Dominic, he could go off and do his own pet projects. We had a meeting every Friday evening at 6 o'clock, and his view was that what had happened under some administrations was that special advisors, because their ministers were in their constituencies usually, often in far-flung parts of the country, on Fridays they would sometimes work from home, and in his view they would take the foot off the gas and not work effectively. I actually found that wasn't the case. I actually found I worked very, very effectively from home because you weren't being interrupted every 5 minutes. But anyway, we had these meetings at 6 o'clock on Friday. And I remember him saying in one of the first ones that, you know, if these meetings at 6 o'clock on a Friday don't suit you, we can always do them on a Saturday or a Sunday. So, you know, that was definitely that sort of slightly malevolent charm. But no, I mean, I will praise him because when we worked on, for example, the Streatham terror attack, which was just over a year ago, or about a year ago, you know, I was in the cabinet room with him, with Boris Johnson, with others, and Priti Patel and others, and my then boss, Robert Buckland. And he was very, very clear. I mean, Boris sent the strategic direction. Boris Johnson said what he wanted to happen. And then Dominic really got into the nitty gritty detail of what he wanted to occur, and changes in the law happened as a result. So I think when he's laser like focused on you, you certainly know about it. But generally, you know, he will, you know, various people made suggestions or said that there were things he did that they disagreed with. certainly a very, very strong character and someone who you wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of, but I personally had no particular problem with him.
I wonder about leaking from Downing Street, because it would seem to me that we're often told somebody close to the minister says, or words like that. Is that usually a special advisor, and do they have permission to do so?
If you see a source close to, you know, Liz Truss, that'll probably be her special advisor. It could also be an MP who's close to them. It could be a minister in the department, for example. It could be them themselves. I've certainly known of instances where a minister themselves rings up a journalist and says, you know, said this becomes a source close to. But usually it's the special advisor. And often, I mean, I've been in one situation, I better not say who it was, but I was in one situation where the minister I worked for rang a journalist and said, say it's a source close to. And Downing Street rang me the next day and said, why are you speaking to this journalist? And I said, it wasn't me. So that was very, very strange. In terms of permission, yes, but that's usually yes. But there's a strange concept, because as a special advisor, you have two approvals. You have the approval from Downing Street and you have the approval from your minister. So whilst I firmly believe you should work, you know, entirely in the interest of your minister, you've got to remember that you're a bit part player. You're taking the back seat and they're very much in the front seat and you can't be a backseat driver. You've got to take your lead from them. It's very clear that you know, most people leaking or giving source quotes or whatever, they do have the authorization of their minister. The question, of course, is what is a leak? You know, if you're putting out something that's beneficial to the government, but the civil service wouldn't be raving about you putting in the public domain, well, that's serving a political purpose and that's something that is authorized by the minister and you know, in many cases authorized by number 10. But a leak that shouldn't happen is, of course, briefing against another department, saying they're not doing the right thing because it's within your interests to do so, or putting something in the public domain that really shouldn't be there. For example, the very, very bad leak and very worrying leak in regard to lockdown. So it's a strange process, but a lot of that is judgment. And I think you've got to, there are things you do that your minister, you know, they're not, it's not really like a line manager. They don't know every single thing you do. They don't know every single conversation you have, an email you send. But in general, I would have to look my minister in the eye and say everything I'd done that day was within their best interests. And the problem comes, I think, when some special advisors have their own sort of furrow to plough, essentially, and their own interests become, in their view, more important than the person they're serving. And you've got to remember you're always second fiddle. And if you forget that, you're in trouble.
Now, the book, it's part biography and it's part history of special advisors. You meld together some wonderful anecdotes alongside some great spads of the past. One personal anecdote that really interested me was when you were in the housing department and you'd literally been there for half an hour and had this massive, massive brief to advise the minister on how he should spend millions of pounds of public money on a big infrastructure project.
Yes, that was £28 million, and I'm really glad that we did spend it, because it was absolutely the right thing to do in terms of housing for homeless people. But yeah, it's a very strange thing that you do have a lot of responsibility. I could have sort of blocked that, I suppose, if I'd wanted to. It was explained to me very, very well by officials, and my advice was to proceed. But it's a very, very strange situation that you do find yourself in, that a lot of things pass your desk that, you know, they'll have gone through lots of different levels of the civil service, but they come up. They come up through the system, and, you know, you're generally the last person to see it before the minister does. So your advice can be crucial. And occasionally I've sent back things to, as a special advisor, I sent back things saying, you know, this is not what we should do, or can we redraft this advice or whatever. So it's, you do have responsibility for a lot of things. And yes, the £28 million was interesting, especially because I recently left the Northern Ireland office, which is a tiny part of government, and its entire budget at that stage was £21 million. So to be sort of signing off a project that was £28 million was a huge change. And of course, the budget of the ministry I was then in, which rejoices in the name the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government, which is just a long and very absurd name for a government department, was, you know, the budget of that was sort of something like £16 or £17 billion. So yeah, it's, you know what they say, you know, a billion here, a billion there, soon adds up to real money. So it's an odd process.
But also having to do it with literally half an hour's experience within the department, that's what I find extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And I think that, you know, you do build up policy knowledge, you do build up expertise, but I suppose in that case, the question they're asking is not necessarily, is this, you know, definitely a good policy? I mean, that's all, it's all been costed, it's all been evaluated and value for money and all the rest of it. The question is, does it politically work? Is it something the minister should be doing as one of their first acts? And actually, I think we came in on the Tuesday and then went on a visit launching the policy, I think on Thursday or something. So that was definitely, you know, very, very busy, very quick thing to do. So yeah, you do make these decisions very, very quickly. And that's the pressure you're under as well. You know, I called it, often you can call in officials and ask them, you know, what's the best way to do this and so on. And also part of the thing with being a special advisor is knowing what you don't know. You know, occasionally I'll get, you know, 200 pages of something to do with, you know, planning or, you know, some sort of new development or something in housing. I mean, that's not my area of expertise. The question I had asked myself is this politically expedient to do so, not to get into, you know, page 129, subsection 3, paragraph 4, about whether the regulations were right or not. There were plenty of official civil servants to do that. So it's knowing your limits and knowing where you can add value, essentially. And that's what I would say to anyone who was thinking about working in politics or especially being a special advisor. The two real things you can bring are knowing the mind of your minister, and the second one is connection to number 10 in the Treasury in terms of being able to get things done. And often civil servants will come to you and say, can you unblock this? Is this something that you can help with? And talk to the special advisors of different departments. And those kind of personal relationships are incredibly important.
Peter, tell us about your relationship with Boris Johnson.
Not a particularly close one, it must be said. I mean, we've sat opposite each other in meetings a number of times, and I've certainly, as a journalist, I've dealt with him a few times. But yeah, it's interesting. What I think you're perhaps asking me is about the latte gate, what historians will call latte gate, which is that the first time I encountered Boris Johnson, I was a student journalist on work experience at the Daily Telegraph back in the day, and it was very, very nice. Editors, the secretary to the editor of the entire paper was a woman called Frances Banks, who's sadly no longer with us. And she was sort of one of the grand dames of Fleet Street and knew everything and knew where the bodies were buried. And she very kindly said to me one time that she was going to, when I was on work experience, that she was going to send me off to the Spectator for a morning. And that was very kind. And off I went and sat in the morning meeting with Boris Johnson and Rod Little and Peter O'Bourne and people like that. And this was circa mid-2000s, probably about 2004, 2005. And Boris Johnson sent me out to get his latte. And he gave me some coins and said, if you get me a latte, and get yourself one as well. Now, sadly, the coins did not cover either his latte, the full extent of his latte, or any of the cost of my latte. So Boris Johnson owes me £2.35 and has for the past 15 years or so. So I will gladly receive that check, postal order, you know, MoneyGram, whatever, however he wants to send it back to me, he's more than welcome to.
Peter, finally, you were fired basically four times. As you say, it's very unpredictable. When your minister goes, you go. But the last time you decided not to pursue this, you've written this wonderful book about the history of special advisors and your own memories. What happens next?
Well, that's a big question, I suppose. The final sacking was in Downing Street, actually, by someone called Lee Kane, who left himself about a month ago. And he delivered the phrase, "The Prime Minister no longer has confidence in your ability to do your job," which was quite strange because until that point, I'd never actually thought about whether the Prime Minister, I was on the Prime Minister's radar at all, or whether presumed at some point he did have confidence in me to do my job. Since I left, I mean, lockdown, I basically wrote the book in lockdown. I've been promoting the book. I've done a bit of consulting, talking to businesses about politics. I've joined the board of a company which provides housing for homeless people. It's a commercial company and makes a profit, but it's providing housing for homeless people and other vulnerable people like prison leavers and survivors of domestic abuse and care leavers, which is something I feel very strongly about as well. And there's a big project in the new year that unfortunately I can't talk about at the moment, but when I'm allowed to talk about it, Georgina, you'll be the first to know.
Politics? Are you tempted?
No, I've seen what I can do. I mean, I've seen the sacrifices people make, and that's actually, if anything comes out of the book, I'd like to kind of humanise politicians a bit more. I mean, yes, there are horrible people. There are people who are in it only for themselves. There are backstabbers and, you know, all the cliches people have about politics. But actually, it's a bit like journalism in that there are the egomaniacs. There are the people who are really difficult and all the rest of it. But the vast majority of people are nice people who are in it for the right reasons. But being an MP is a really tough job. I think being a minister is even tougher. And being a Secretary of State is one of the toughest jobs I've ever come across, and seeing it up close. And I was glad to play a sort of walk-on kind of cameo role for 3.5 years. But in terms of elected politics, it's just not for me, I'm afraid.
Very many thanks to Peter Cardwell. The Secret Life of Special Advisors by Peter Cardwell is published by Biteback and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer Court. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our app, our website, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.